Attention, please. Places for top of show. Places for top of show. Hello, and welcome to Twins Talk Theater. We are Cindy.
And Stacy.
And we're talking about theater, backstage life, and all the excitement that the audience doesn't get to see.
Enjoy the show.
Welcome. Today we are interviewing Sean Bart, though on all of his information it says Sean Alexander Bart, mm-hmm. full name. Sean is a musical director, teaches piano, teaches voice, plays in the pit.
I'm an actor and a songwriter, a composer, arranger.
Oh, I've never seen you act. Nice. Gonna have to watch out for that one day.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How did you get into all of the above theater, performing, acting, music stuff?
Well, when I was a kid, my dad started taking me to the opera when I was 5 years old.
Yay, ah. Opera!
Yeah, and we had season tickets to the San Francisco Opera for 10 years. So by the time I was 15, I had seen 100 operas.
Wow.
And
have you even seen that many operas?
Nope. He's probably seen more than I have. Yeah. That's awesome.
And I started taking music at the San Francisco Conservatory when I was about 5. Started piano when I was 7 and was singing in choir. And as I grew up, I was a competition level classical pianist.
Wow.
And singing in choirs. And then I had the lead in my middle school musical.
What was that?
The Feather Duster. There's a reason you've never heard of it.
So yeah, it's a middle school show.
It's a new one to me.
And in high school, I did Guys and Dolls, and the girl I had a crush on then invited me to do a summer program of a teen theater company. I was like, okay. And so I did, and that began I think it was with that company for 18 years.
Wow.
Started as an actor, and then once I was no longer a teenager, I moved on to being a vocal coach and accompanist and music director for them.
Nice. And that was up in San Francisco too?
Yeah.
Are they still around?
They are. They are. I think they're approaching 35 years.
Wow. Good job.
Yeah. It's run through San Francisco Park and Rec. So it's actually a government-funded program.
Nice. El Segundo, I know, has one of those.
Really?
I did technical directing and design for some shows in the summertime. They would do youth shows in their rec room and build the sets and the outside basketball court.
It's great. For me, it changed my life. And for a lot of us who were kind of misfits and had problems at home or whatever, it was a place where, you know, kids from all over San Francisco came together and had our little community that put on shows. And a lot of us went into professional theater. Lena Hall is one of them. And other people have been on Broadway.
Nice.
And gone into education or various artistic pursuits. Some people have gone into politics. Some people are just regular
common, everyday people,
muggles.
Not in theater. Muggles, commoners.
Who, nice. Of course, have much more stable lives than we do.
This is true. They know when they're going to work, when they're coming home, what the mm-hmm. next job is. So was your dad a musician?
No, he's just a big lover of classical music, especially opera and that sort of thing.
That's really cool. So many people don't go to opera, but then to bring a kid to opera, you're probably the only kid in the audience for most shows.
I was, and I was constantly people saying, oh, wow, he's so well-behaved.
Yeah, because operas can be long and not they always can. The most exciting to watch.
Well, generally, I loved it. I would get involved emotionally. Sometimes I'd get really bored.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting how my tastes have evolved, because there are certain operas I've been listening to since I was 5 years old. And how you interact with something that's sophisticated changes a lot from the time you're a child to now that I've been doing professional theater and music for over however long it's been. Your perspective changes a lot.
Yeah, well, at 5 years old, you're following the basic story and you know the basic characters, but not really any of the deeper stuff, so.
Right, right.
Well, what, can you give some examples? Like, what stuff did you really enjoy when you were younger versus what do you prefer to listen to now? Or is that kind of the same, like? Carmen, you just love all the time.
Yeah, there are certain things like the Magic Flute, which was the first that my dad took me to see the Ingmar Bergman film version of the Magic Flute when I was 4, I think. And I still remember it. Nice. It's one of my enduring memories from childhood. And
that's such a good one for kids because there's so much magic and animals and great music. And
the songs are catchy and easy to remember.
Right. And then as my understanding of music grew, I was able to absorb the score on so many different levels. So when I was a kid, I enjoyed it in one manner. And then as I grew up, I was able to embrace the larger picture of the opera.
All the nuances,
the orchestration and the way that the themes are used and the harmonic structure underlying things. Lots of boring stuff to people who aren't into that kind of thing.
Lots of sound, language, and words and stuff. Have you performed it or been in the orchestra for it?
No. I haven't done a lot of opera. It takes a lot of dedication to be in that world as a performer. And as I got older, I really got into pop and rock and musical theater. And at some point I realized I wasn't going to be a concert pianist because I couldn't spend 8 hours alone in a room.
Practicing
every single day. Mm-hmm. So performing on in musical theater really kind of embraced everything that I was into. Lots of different genres. You know, every show is a different style of music, unless you're doing only Rodgers and Hammerstein.
But nobody wants to just do Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Well, some people do.
No, I like a variety.
Right. So you do Jesus Christ Superstar, and then you're doing Guys and Dolls, and then you're doing a William Finn musical. You know, those are three very distinct styles of music and styles of show with different kind of arcs and different kind of characters and different styles of singing. And that's probably what's most interesting to me about musical theater.
That you can change it up and do something different every show.
Right. I don't always love the storytelling.
Yeah, there's plot holes in a lot of them.
Right. And a lot of kind of clunky arcs. So being someone who's employed in musical theater, I embrace that aspect of it a lot.
I remember when we were doing Fame, that was one of your, least favorite?
Yes.
The plot for that one isn't the most deep or well-rounded.
No, it's very formulaic and not imaginative within the formula. Because there are certain formulas that are used that are infused with a lot of clever dialogue and insightful archetypes and whatnot. Fame is not.
not living, who's dying, who's dating who. It's just the way it is through the whole show.
Yeah.
But you still did it. So then how do you do a show that you don't really like? Like, do you have to find something to love about it? Is it a job at that point? How do you do a show like that?
Well, the main reason I decided to do Fame was because of the community here, the staff, the people I get to work with, like you and Joel and Kim, and then the students. There's one of the reasons I've continued to do children's theater and youth theater is that there's a purpose to it beyond just going and doing a show. Mm-hmm. Not all of these students are going to go on to have professional theater careers, but the community that we're building and the work that we do enriches all of us. And that's what this process is about.
Yeah, I think that's a very big one. We've talked about it, Sydney and I, with a number of different people, about education versus like building the community and getting people involved and teaching them stuff in how to function in the real life, even if they don't go into theater. But even in theater, how to function in the theater world outside of the education world. And I think that's a big one because they don't teach that other places. And I know here you guys do a lot of like audition workshops and how to dress, how to take headshots, how to do backstage stuff. There's volunteers backstage that you guys are all you know, you and Kim and Joel and everyone are a part of. And I think that's really important to show the kids. It's more than go on stage and sing, but you have to learn how to dance and learn how to sing and learn how to act and learn how to do all those other things that are involved in it.
And you have to learn how to do shows that you don't like.
Really like.
Not every show is your favorite show.
Yeah, you don't get cast in your favorite part every time or something like that.
And part of the gig is maintaining a professional attitude and staying positive and not bringing your resentments or frustrations into the room.
Yeah, that's always a big one. Because the cast right now that we're doing the show Beauty and the Beast is 45 kids.
45 kids.
It's a lot of children. And they're all junior high and high school, I think, right?
Nobody's over... I believe 10 to 16.
10 to 16.
And we only have a couple 16-year-olds, a couple of 15-year-olds, and then everyone else is 10 to 14.
Yeah, but they're doing an excellent job.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I didn't see any of the rehearsals until the designer run, but even between the designer run and opening night, some of the kids grew a lot and are a lot more confident. And backstage, Maurice is the kid who's playing Maurice. His mom was backstage. And the first time he went on stage to sing the opening number, she was in the wings crying. She was so happy that he was out on stage doing something. It's like, oh, that's why we're doing this.
That's exactly. And, you know, we could have cast that role, for example, with an adult.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, there's not that many guys around. Let's fill out the cast by bringing in a dad to play this role. It's not the largest role in the show. It's one song and then a couple of scenes. Mm-hmm. But instead, we gave this fantastic young man an opportunity that who knows what it'll lead to, but he'll always remember that. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful event for his whole family.
Yeah.
His mom and his sister are at every single performance.
Yeah, and they've been volunteering backstage almost every performance.
Yeah.
And he's opened up a lot. He's backstage talking to the other kids. He's helping do costume changes. I think it's helping his, his confidence is growing.
Yeah.
And so that's really cool to see too.
Yeah.
So this is his first show?
Yes.
I think so, yeah.
It's definitely his first role. He may have done ensemble in some shows. I'm not sure.
But this is definitely a first lead role for him. And, you know, it's not perfect, but he's also doing a great job for being his first show and having to sing a solo on stage in front of 300 people. So
yeah, I still can't do that.
Right. Yeah. I know a lot of adults who
I don't.
would be terrified, petrified to do that.
Yeah, so that's really cool. So do you do other... I know you're here at the Norris a lot. Do you work at other theaters?
Not regularly. I've worked with Cupcake Theater in North Hollywood a bunch.
Oh, I haven't heard of them.
They, the house is about 150, 200 seats.
Got it.
And they recently did Into the Woods and Hairspray and Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, those are pretty big shows for a smaller theater.
Yeah. And they pack the house almost every night.
That's excellent.
Yep. So I did a lot of sub work for them. Subbing being taking over for the music director or the band leader. And I've done some work with original musicals. One in particular is Upstairs, the musical, which my friend Wayne Self wrote, which we premiered in New Orleans a few years ago.
Nice. What is the plotter?
So there was... In a fire in New Orleans in 1973, which killed 42 people in a gay bar.
Wow.
And up until that point, it was the deadliest arson attack against that community in the country's history up until the Orlando shooting
of
the Pulse.
Yeah,
right.
Not long ago.
So... there were no plays about it or musicals, and it generally just wasn't in the general consciousness. Mm-hmm. And Wayne came across it and thought it would be a great subject to write a musical commemorating this community, which was very tight-knit, performing and just social club with a kind of a cabaret club attached to it.
That's pretty cool. So So since it took place in New Orleans, you guys premiered it down there. How was the audience reaction?
It was amazing. It was cathartic for them. It was the 40th anniversary. We actually performed on the 40th anniversary of the fire.
Good planning and timing on his part.
Yes, it was one of those once in a lifetime opportunities that you can't make it happen. Things just fall into place, and then you say, all right, here we go. We're flying everyone out to New Orleans and putting the show up. And it was a community event for the whole city.
Yeah, because they were there. A lot of them probably remembered it and read about it.
They had friends. They had family. We had a couple of family members from across the country come in to see this musical.
Wow. So did he write the words and you did the music, or you guys collaborated
on all of it? He's also a composer and a player. So he wrote everything, and then I music directed. I help a little bit with fleshing out some of the piano parts. And we're in talks to collaborate on a musical right now, or at least a few songs.
That's pretty cool.
But I'm really busy. My plate is full.
Yes, we're a little busy right now at the Norris with a couple different projects we keep putting you on. Like, oh, Sean can do that. He can just do all the shows we do here.
Right. And I don't live here. You know, I commute 45 minutes to an hour each direction.
Yeah.
I know the roads very well.
Yeah.
Coming down to Palos Verdes.
Isn't it nice at midnight when nobody's on the road?
It still takes a half hour.
Yeah, but not an hour.
Right.
Getting to Long Beach, it's like, well, it can be 20 minutes or it can be an hour, depending on what road I take and what traffic hits.
Right. How is Celebration going?
Allegiance?
I'm sorry, Allegiance.
It's going well. We preview, from the recording of this, previews start tonight, but I think this recording will probably go out on Friday, so previews will have already started. We open on the 26th or 28th, whatever next Wednesday is. But 28th. It's also 28th. It's also one of those pieces, like you were saying about the New Orleans one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really talked about much in school. We never learned about the history of what happened, the Japanese internment camps and being picked up and moved and all of that. Cindy and I knew about it because we traveled a lot with our family, and we've been to one of them, the one in Northern California. So we knew about it. But watching this musical, yeah, I think it's bringing a lot of the, like you were saying, the community out. They've sold way more tickets than they were expecting. Of course, it's going on in Little Tokyo and George Takei is involved. So that brings a lot of people. But it's getting a lot of good attention and bringing focus to a part of history that is generally ignored by most people. And that's cool. And it's also, I think, a good musical. You know, it has holes like all of them, but the songs are catchy. They get stuck in your head. So that's always a helpful part of a musical.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of good energy about it when it was on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
and you know, Lea Salonga was in it.
Yeah,
and is Janelle in this production?
I think Janelle's in this production. Yeah,
and
Lea's not, but George Takei is. There's three or four people in this one that came from Broadway. I think the choreographer is the same, but the whole production design is brand new to LA. So it's a whole different production team and design and everything like that. But of course,
I better get my tickets.
Yeah. Cindy's flying out, so she could see it on opening with me.
Yeah, we're pretty excited. I just took my dress to the dry cleaner, so I'll look pretty for opening night.
Still working on that for me. Got to find a dress. So you say that you are a composer and stuff too. I know you're busy. Have you composed anything recently or played anything that you've composed recently in concerts?
Most of the stuff that I've performed is singer-songwriter stuff. My compositions tend to be piano and kind of classical-based avant-garde blues.
Wait, is that all together as one?
Yes. That is all together as one.
Nice.
Because I have so many different interests musically. I mean, one day I'm listening to new age music, so I need to, you know, just chill out and get centered. Then the next day I'm listening to some heavy metal. Then the next day I'm listening to show tunes.
Whatever.
And it's, you know, sometimes it's research because I'm listening. Oh, gotta listen to Fame.
Yep. Gotta learn the music.
Uh huh. At least once through. Just gotta make it once.
So it's me with opera all the time. Like 2 weeks before a show, depending on the show, I'll start listening to it. Like, I know I have Faust coming up, but I've done it twice. So I was like, I could put that off a little bit longer. I don't quite need to listen to it. And then I did a world premiere recently, and it was so weird because obviously there was no music to it. There was no recording. And I was like, this is the first show I've ever done with no recording. This is so strange. How am I supposed to memorize the music?
Right. But how did you memorize it?
Yeah.
They had somebody do a MIDI file recording, which I would never recommend, especially for an opera, because it wasn't even piano, because it was a MIDI file. It like was all computerized and all sounded the same. And so it took me forever to even figure out like what part to listen to as the voices versus the orchestration part. So, I listened to that over and over. So I at least kind of knew rhythms before I stepped into the rehearsal hall. The good thing is nobody else knew what was going on either, because nobody else, you know, they'd all like learn their own parts, but we did a lot of music rehearsals so that everybody could get on the same page. But it was so interesting because you're so used to doing shows that everybody knows, you know, like Fame or Beauty and the Beast, where you kind of go in knowing what to expect. So to do a new piece, you just kind of walk in blind.
Right. So when I was doing the New Orleans show upstairs, we were in the middle of rehearsals and Wayne would walk in with a stack of papers. Hey guys, new song.
Right. Hey, I wrote this. Yeah.
And inevitably it would be brilliant. It'd be like, okay, give us a few days to make this work.
Yeah.
Let us execute your vision.
You got to learn it and then manipulate it. And, you know, once you learn the notes, you have to actually learn how to sing it and not just, you know, where to take breaths and what the emotion is and all the background work that goes into singing.
And when it comes to that, my greatest vehicle in my artistic life is being a pianist and being able to sight read and being able to improvise and play off court and be able to do all of those at the same time and switch back and forth, then also talk to singers while I'm doing it.
It's a lot of brain work.
But I've been doing it, it's so long that it's very natural to me. And I'm also being a singer, it really helps.
Yeah, you can speak their language and know what how their tongue is placed or what they're trying to do.
And also know how it is that singers count, for example, versus other instrumentalists, because singers have a different kind of internal rhythm than instrumentalists do. Huh. And so there's a different kind of tempo shift that happens with singers, and you can kind of feel, oh, they're about to take a breath, and the breath is going to take 3/4 of a second, and that just gets worked into the musical phrase.
Interesting. Never thought about that.
Yeah. Though it's not really the same with jazz singers or stuff like that, because they backphrase. And so jazz singers kind of detach themselves from the steady pulse and are in and out of the pulse.
Well, do you not have musical theater singers who do that?
Who
I feel like that to backphrase.
Yeah, but that's usually secondary.
Not as much as jazz singers.
Right. I always insist that the singers learn the music as written and then make changes based on character work. So if they're going to make a change to the score, then it should be supported by the direction or the scene or the relationship, whatever emotion is happening in that moment, then we can find a justification for it. Otherwise, I want to honor what the composer created. One of the things that I often say, depending on the show, is, for example, with Spelling Bee, which we just did, William Finn, the composer, he's the genius in the room. The rest of us are executing the genius's work.
Yeah, it all starts with the script and music.
Yes, and he's a brilliant, brilliant composer. His writing is insightful, and it reflects human emotion. And on the surface, it can look awkward. It can look like, oh, why is the rhythm so precise? Why are these notes doing this sort of movement. It'd be so much easier if we just did it this way. Well, that's true, but there's a reason he wrote it that way, and he's the genius in the room. So we are here to execute his vision.
Yeah, so you kind of have to stay with what he wrote, otherwise we're not performing.
And it's very similar to opera. In opera, you don't change the rhythm.
Yeah.
Well, that actually depends on what era of opera you're working in.
True.
Yeah, your modern stuff,
you don't change the rhythm, but actually, I think it's, I should know this, stuff like Bel Canto and prior, the music wasn't actually written down when they created it. So the music we have for a lot of Bel Canto arias is based on the most popular singer who sang it at that time period.
Right.
But that's mostly Bel Canto, and that's because there's so much ornamentation in it. But a lot of other stuff, you do what's written, right. And especially modern music, which is what I focus on. You know, they, like you said, they wrote it for a reason. And even if it's awkward and difficult, you know, you're doing a John Adams piece or a Philip Glass piece, which is very difficult to sing. Like,
right.
They wrote it like that for a reason. There's a reason that, you know, the key signature changes every three measures or whatever. Mm-hmm. You got to stick to it. But which was also interesting with the new work that I just did, because Julian Grant was the composer and Mark Campbell was the librettist, but they were both in rehearsal with us on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And they were there for the orchestra read, and we had four orchestra reads. But because it was the first time ever being performed, and so to actually have these two men who wrote this piece in the room with us, there were a number of times where either an instrumentalist or maestro would turn and be like, did you really mean this? Or was this a mistake? Was this a typo? You know, actually what you meant? Yeah. It was a really cool experience to have them there and to ask them questions and to be like, why did you write this? Why do you have the horns playing differently than you would have the strings play? But
right. So
musical, yeah, I agree that because that's more of a modern thing, you know, musicals don't go back to the 1500s. It's written for a reason. You need to sing it that way.
Right. And one of the purposes of opera pre-1850 or whatever was as a social gathering. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people would come and socialize during a lot of it. And then they'd wait for the big aria. And right, everyone would stop what they were doing and listen to the big aria. And then whoever was singing it got to kind of do whatever the hell they wanted with it.
Yep.
And then oftentimes they'd have to, if they were good enough, everyone would shout encore and they'd sing it again. And if it was good enough, they'd do it a third time, a fourth, fifth. There are stories about someone having to do an aria seven times.
That has to be exhausting on the voice.
But right in the middle of the opera.
Just do it again. It's like repeat on the song.
Right. So if you had certain tricks you could do, you did the tricks, even if they weren't written.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In that way, it's much more similar to performance-based music like rock shows nowadays, where the singer bases his performance, his or her performance, on a recording, and then makes changes based on either how they're feeling or how the song has progressed in the years since the recording happened.
Mm-hmm. Or if the audience keeps screaming a certain song title, they do that, or
Free Bird.
Yeah.
So I have a question about your education. Did you go to school as like a collaborative pianist? Did you go as a not a concert pianist, because you said that's not what you want to do, but did you do that, or are you here today based on just experience, real world experience?
I did not go as a collaborative pianist. That was just something that happened. I was a performer first. So okay. I was a solo pianist, and then I was an actor, and I was a singer, and that's what I wanted to do. And I was actually a voice major in college. And there are more opportunities as a collaborative pianist than there are for anything else. You can play for dance classes. You can play for musicals. You can play for singers. You can play for chamber music. You can play for auditions. There's so many different things for a good pianist who can play different genres, sight read, improvise, and follow a singer and or instrumentalist.
Exactly.
You can work all the time.
Yeah, but there's always auditions or something.
I'm a performer first, not someone who wants to be accompanying someone else. And that's been a real challenge for me in my career, that so often I'm in the pit when I want to be on stage. So when we do shows like Camp Rock and the band gets to be on stage and I get to put on guy liner and spike my hair up.
You did have pretty exciting outfits.
And wear a leather jacket. That's a step towards where I want to be.
Nice. So we need to design you onto the stage more often.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. I'm not sure if that'll happen anytime soon.
If you want to get me to do a show that I otherwise didn't want to do.
Oh, so we should have put you in the stage for fame. I think we put you in the pit for fame.
Yeah,
because or backstage or something.
I didn't care enough. Because I want to have, if I'm on stage, I want to have fun. So it was on, during Spelling Bee, I was on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great. Yes, I adore that show. I love the script. I love the characters. I worship the music. So to be on stage, living that out, to be playing it with a, you know, conducted, the orchestra was in the wing, so we had a little camera on me.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to be giving cues while playing and not distracting too much from what was happening on stage. It's great. It was a great balance.
Because you sat there the whole time on stage left on a platform with a keyboard.
I didn't think you were that distracting, and I look at music directors all the time. I'm just trained to, as a stage manager, to watch for the cues. So, and if I didn't think you were distracting, I think you did a great job.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I was at a show. My God. My husband and I and a friend just went and saw Sweeney Todd off Broadway, mm-hmm. and the band, it's a piano, violin, and a horn. He played a couple different things. But they were on stage, and all the time, because I know Sweeney so well, I've done it twice. When I knew a cue was coming up, I totally watched the pianist conductor because I knew the stage manager was taking the next light cue off of what he did. So
right.
It was very entertaining for me. I must have watched him half the time and, you know, the cast the rest of the time, but
it's an amazing art conducting and cueing from the piano. Because
right, and playing at the same time.
Right. You know, a traditional cue happens with your hands.
Yeah.
But you can't, when you're playing those piano, you can't use your hands to cue something. So I learned on the job how to cue with my shoulders and with my chin or my nose. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember, we were trying to get the camera focused.
I talked over you.
Yeah, I know. And then I stopped, then you stopped.
Oh,
Who's going to go?
We do this all the time. I remember we were trying to focus the camera on you and get your platform situated appropriately so as many of the musicians and actors on stage could see you so they could see the cues and still, you know, do their part, which most people probably don't think of. They're like, oh, put them on stage. It's like, oh, there's so many other things that go into that.
Right, just finding the right camera angle.
Yeah.
You know, I was constantly tweaking for days to get just the right angle so that the light wasn't causing a glare and they can see my left hand, but the left hand isn't blocking the right hand and my shoulders are in view. You don't need to see my whole face, but it's good if you can see my chin. Yeah.
They just see your nose to shoulders, a little past your shoulders. I don't know what the actual end image was. Did they see your whole face or only half your face?
It was half my face. It's my best side.
Good, as long as you approve of it.
that was the band off stage only saw that much.
Yeah, that's what we, because we had a camera on them.
Huh?
They couldn't see because of the wings.
Well, I watch conductors breathe, and I watch their eyes a lot. I mean, I watch their hands, but I think I would feel weird as a stage manager not seeing a conductor's eyes.
Right.
But I guess as a musician, you're not staring at the screen the whole time, you're watching your music. Whereas I tend to stare at the screen most of the time to watch for my cues.
Right. The musicians are set up so that the music stands are in high enough that over the music stand, they can see the TV screen kind of in their peripheral vision.
Oh, okay.
So they can be reading the music and watching the larger gesture that I'm making with my shoulders or chin or chest or whatever it is.
Right. And not small cues, which a stage manager will watch for a downbeat or a breath.
Right, precisely.
Yeah, I don't remember, it was Chris Murray on that show, right? I don't remember him. He wasn't watching the camera. He was just watching you from the booth, so.
Right.
I guess he was fine. He never complained about it, so I never had to worry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if he could just see him from the booth, then yeah, that's the easiest.
It's also not a very cue-heavy show.
Yeah, not really.
Yeah, but he had a number of bump cues when they would go to the, who was a guy that would like go into this like outer world kind of thing, and the whole stage would go like purpley gobble.
Coney Bear.
Oh yeah, Coney Bear every time he.
Those are some pretty tight bump cues.
Yeah, so he got him. That's good.
Yeah, he did good.
But it's so interesting that the coordination that goes into a production, like this, it's amazing. And I am not a tech person, but just over all the shows that I've done, I've learned so much terminology and so much of what you guys do, and I respect your art as much as anything else that happens. And those logistics that we put in place are what make a show happen. And that is the magic as much as the music is.
Yeah. Otherwise it's just people on stage singing, but.
And if the cues aren't clean, then that takes the audience out of the moment, and it kind of dissipates the impact of what we want to achieve.
Yeah. It's the small details that, you know, they can get annoying, especially during tech week, to call the same cue over and over and over. But it's like, yeah, but if you miss that cue, then that whole moment's gone.
Right. So, you know, at this point in my career, I get frustrated when we don't run it 10 times.
Yeah, because it's like, why don't we have this down?
Let's take the time. Okay, so we don't have 20 minutes to waste. Let's not waste the 20 minutes. Let's take 20 minutes, run it until everyone knows exactly what's happening, and then we'll never have to do it again.
Yeah, it's second nature. We'll just move on to the next cue we weren't getting right. Work on that one.
It's actually something I learned early on studying piano, because I was playing very complicated classical pieces, and my teacher instilled in me, well, if you have two measures that you keep getting wrong, don't practice the whole piece. Just isolate those two measures.
Yeah.
Run them forwards, backwards, fast, slow. Do it one hand at a time. Change up the rhythm to give it a different cadence.
Whatever to get it into your fingers and body and ears.
Right. And then once you have it, you'll always have it. And you'll never botch that section again.
Huh. Yeah. Kind of a weird side story, but that's how Cindy and I play video games. I think we played Donkey Kong Country one level about 20 times before we got it.
No, I think it was about 20 hours. It took us a very, very long time to get that level.
But then once we got it, I don't think we've ever failed on it again, because we played it so many times. We knew every jump and every exactly when to hit the button.
And so it wasn't chance. No, you weren't leaving anything to chance.
No, we knew exactly what was happening.
And that's how you master something, by playing Donkey Kong.
Yep, exactly. Kind of
Donkey
the
same. Donkey Kong Country. Yeah.
Donkey Kong Country,
it was,
the mine
the
cart.
One where you're in a little like go-kart jumping over things, It was a great, one of my favorite levels still.
I was just reading an article about the Donkey Kong's heritage and like all the different incarnations of the characters and how they relate to each other. I didn't understand it at all.
But you read the whole article?
I did. Because it was still interesting. Because there's so many different theories. And these games have just been... when did the first Donkey Kong...
Yeah, right, early
80s. Early 80s, right?
Because that was just him climbing up the stairs, right?
Mario was
chasing him. At that point, the title character was Donkey Kong, not Mario.
Yeah.
And then soon enough, Nintendo came out with Super Mario Brothers. And then ever since, there's been all these different incarnations. And I don't know that there's been one project manager to make sure that the world of Donkey Kong / Mario has...
is the same.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny because even in those worlds, they change so much. Well, like Zelda's kind of in the Mario world, but not really in the Mario world. But there's so many different Zelda games, but they're not all the same. I get confused on how they're related to each other. But some people have come up with stories on how, where they land in the timeline and how they all go together. Oh, okay.
Better them than me.
Yeah, I don't understand them, but... I mean, I follow it in, like, the nerdy Marvel world, but not really kind of the video game worlds. Okay, so what is a piece that you would like to, or show or something you'd like to do, either in the pit or musical, direct, or performing that you haven't done before, that you, like, really want to work on?
There's shows I've done a couple times that I would like to do again. I haven't done it in a while. I personally have grown as an artist, or because I have certain students who I would love to see to certain roles. One is A Chorus Line.
Oh, that would...
I love A Chorus Line. I played it when I was 17. I think it was the first show I actually played. And I had a real Fender Rhodes and other awesome keyboard sounds going on. And that was my first foray into pit playing. And that score is one of a kind. And especially the instrumentation just captures the feel of the mid-70s to mid-80s.
Plus every character is unique in that. And so it has their own sound and style for each character.
And we can all see elements of us in those characters, especially those of us who are artists, have been through what all these characters have been through.
Yeah, especially the whole auditioning part and who's going to get cast and the stress of that.
Or for someone like me, who's a teacher and a performer, one of the main characters says, I don't want to be teaching other people to do what I want to be doing.
Interesting. I haven't seen that one live. I've only seen the movie of it. Does it follow closely to the movie, or
I does the movie follow closely? Never to watched the movie since I was a kid because it just didn't appeal to me, and I know that many people consider it disappointing.
The movie version,
yeah, that it doesn't follow the stage production that faithfully.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a show I'd love to do. Jesus Christ Superstar is another one that I love.
Would you want to play the music for it or be in it as an actor or both?
Both.
That's one that I feel you could easily do both in. You could easily bring music in as characters playing the music.
Wouldn't that be cool?
That can be, you know, like Godspell and all. It can easily be done one in the same.
I did Godspell.
Nice. What did you
play? I played Jesus back when I had long hair and a ponytail.
Very appropriate.
And that was fun. It was great.
Did they have you playing any instruments in that, or just singing?
Just singing. Yeah. I've done a few shows. In fact, most of the professional shows I've done as an actor have been because I'm a musician. So like the Buddy Holly story, Janis Joplin, a show called Pump Boys and Dinettes. Do you know that?
Is that the Janis Joplin one?
No.
Oh, it's
it takes place in a diner.
I don't know that one. Twin, do you know that one?
No, I haven't heard of that one either.
Pump Boys and Pump Boys, like from a gas station. They, you know, yeah, they work on cars, and then dinettes, a couple waitresses at the local diner.
Interesting.
Yes, it was. I think it was a bunch of friends who had written some songs together. And they're like, well, let's put a musical around it so we can sing our songs in a musical.
Yeah, perfect.
And there's a part for a pianist who plays accordion. It was my first time playing accordion on stage.
Are you trained in that, or did you have to learn for the part?
No, I'm not a great accordionist. the buttons, beyond my level of
expertise. It's not close enough to a piano with keys. It's
the keys are the fact that you have to get the bellows going that wasn't too hard to deal with. But then the buttons with the cords, is something completely different from it. It follows the circle of fifths, which harmonically I understand, but it's a grid that you have to be really familiar with, and it, no way for that to be second nature without studying it regularly for a decent amount of time.
Huh.
Like you can, at least I could picture the grid, but my fingers couldn't navigate this row of buttons in the moment while singing and engaging with an audience.
Yeah, because you can't really look at it. That would be a little awkward to try to stare at it.
Right, so you're just kind of feeling your way up and down these buttons.
Do they have bumps on them or anything, like a keyboard?
So the center one does for the C chord. And so you would find your place on C. This, as I remember, it's been a while since I did it, but that's what I remember. The C major button has a little dimple in it, and then you can find your way up the circle of fifths or down the circle of fifths from there.
Wow. We have a friend who plays accordion, but I've bought one for a prop, and that's about my extent of accordion knowledge. It needed to be read. That was the only qualifications for a prop. Yeah. That's all they care about.
I don't think I've ever actually touched one. I may have only seen them in like pictures.
Do you think you'll get cooties off of it or something?
I mean, I guess they're not really in that many operas. I don't think I've ever actually physically seen one in person. I mean, maybe a street performer, but...
Maybe Tales of Hoffman might have one?
Yeah, I haven't done that one.
What? The Long Beach Opera show that I did, I don't remember if you were out for, the Spanish one about the drug dealers overlords.
No, I didn't do that one.
Oh, that's what I needed an accordion for. I forget the name of that one.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah, that's the only reason I've ever needed one, because he needed a red accordion, which was fairly hard to find, because they're kind of expensive.
I had to play accordion for Fiddler on the Roof, which we did here a couple years ago, and I was conducting and playing lead keyboard on it, which is probably not something I would do again on Fiddler. But the accordion playing was kind of beyond my ken, as well as being impossible to conduct
while playing accordion.
A 13-piece orchestra while playing accordion. So I ended up doing it on a keyboard and getting a good set of patches.
It's like, I do not remember you having an accordion in that show. What was I doing during that show?
Because then we would have had to mic it and all that stuff.
Okay, that makes more sense.
Yeah, it was just a keyboard.
I ignored the pit, apparently.
What songs is the accordion in? Because I did it once, but I don't remember an accordion.
In Fiddler?
Like throughout or in the...
I think...
When they're in the tavern celebrating Lachaim or...
Yeah, and there's some in the opening. It's mostly a rhythm instrument. It kind of takes place of the piano in a lot of places. And I'm trying to think if... Did we use the alternate orchestration? Because there's a newer orchestration which more closely resembles a klezmer band than the original. The original is more symphonic in nature. And then with the revival, they made it more traditional instruments.
I have no idea.
So it doesn't sound
version.
Quite as much like a symphony orchestra.
That would be you.
Right, because the revival was smaller?
Yeah. Yeah.
Orchestra?
I would assume we would do that for money-saving reasons, but I don't remember.
Yeah, you know what? I think we did the traditional and then just cut down the books that we used. There's not that much accordion. Maybe on four or five of the numbers. It just adds flavor here and there.
So it was fairly simple to translate that to a piano score?
Yeah, I had to find the right patches to make the accordion sound authentic.
Got it.
Which, again, I knew nothing about, so I had to do some research.
Don't really know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's one of the things as a music director that you don't take into account when you're signing up for something is, there's the rehearsal time. Then there's the time learning the score. Then it's... Oh, I have to figure out how to get an accordion sound that sounds halfway decent. oh, I have to figure out how to rearrange the string books so I make sure that the string section sounds full.
Yeah, or with that, less people. And then teaching the kids or privates with the kids on getting them to learn their music and all that. Yeah, lots of background work people don't pay attention to. Or have to. Like, they come, they see a show, it's great, they go home.
Right, and there's a lot of talk in the music director community about not getting recognition. Often in reviews, we don't get recognition. Mm-hmm. In the press, they'll list the director and the choreographer.
Yeah, occasionally a designer, but that's about it.
And then in a lot of the press releases, it'll directed by, then choreography, and then lighting, wigs, costumes, sets, music director. And it's an odd thing because in during the process, there are three main creative positions, which are the director, the choreographer, and the music director.
Yeah, you guys are in the room with the people figuring it out. I deal with you guys and then the designers, but yeah, they're just like the stage management and technical director, they're never listed in anything.
Stage manager does as much work, if not more work, than anyone else.
Yeah, not listed.
But our job, the stage manager and the music director, is to not be noticed.
Yeah.
Our job is to not distract from everything else that happens. If we're doing our job well, then no one notices. If we don't do our job well, that's when people notice because we screwed it up.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. What I find interesting, and I think what's difficult for stage managers when you transition particularly from the musical theater world to the opera world, is how drastically different that music person is in the opera world.
Yeah.
Like you said, in musical theater and in straight shows, the director is kind of God and they get all the recognition. You step into opera land and like maestro is God, mm-hmm. You know? If there's a dispute between maestro and the director, maestro wins. You know, if maestro needs more time, maestro gets more time. And it's all about the music. So it's so, so drastically different. And
it took
me a while because I started in musical theater, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was used to asking the director how they were, asking the music director how they were. And I got into opera and the director was always like, oh no, it's music time. And I was like, yeah, but do you need staging? He's like, nope, it's music time. And I was like, oh, okay. And they're always the first to be mentioned too, you know? It's always the composer first, the director second. So it's just weird how I wonder when in history that happened, you know, because musicals started from opera. So why all of a sudden did we get rid of the importance of the musical aspect of it in musicals?
Well, musicals kind of arose from operetta and vaudeville and kind of music hall, I guess, music hall tradition. And I mean, certainly in vaudeville, it's about the
acts.
Right, exactly. The variety of the acts. And most early musicals were a collection of songs performed by artists. And it was about, I mean, think about Anything Goes, which is a very silly story, mm-hmm. kind of absurd. And a lot of, I don't know, slapstick kind of vaudeville type stuff around a bunch of songs. And so it was the director's job to create the right platform for the music to be performed.
Yeah, plus the music, a lot of the songs were taken from others and everyone knew Cole Porter. So it's not like that was a new, big, exciting thing. They knew the music, so then they're putting a story around it.
Right, and then also people were performing those songs at home.
Yeah, they knew them.
Song folios would be published, and so people would have parties and whatnot, or just sing around the piano after dinner. And that was the one of the common entertainments.
Yeah, so maybe because it became common that everyone could do that style of music, the music became less...
Less about the
fancy.
Music director?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I still think you deserve recognition.
Yeah, I'm considering a career change to opera now, where I can go get some recognition.
Yeah, they're like top bill.
Mm-hmm. You get a spotlight, you get applause when you walk out. Nobody can do anything until we find you, because nobody can ever find Maestro. I feel like the operas I've done, where is he? We need to start. Can't find Maestro.
It's very true. It's very, very true.
But I it's not really my style. I've done certain musicals which approach, you know, I did Secret Garden, which approaches that. And I wanted to collaborate.
It's not as collaborative. Basically, like, this is the way it is, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, and that's a lot of pressure, too. I don't want to be an expert on the history of the opera, the particular piece that I'm doing. I don't want to be completely obsessed with the score, because I have too many other things I'd like to do. And I just, it very similar to when I realized I couldn't be a concert pianist, that, well, I want to do other stuff besides be in a practice room 8 hours a day practicing.
Yeah. So you have to give up that and go for something else, but
and
think it worked out okay?
Right. I got to go play basketball.
Yeah, that's not something. Piano players are so picky about their hands. If you're a classic pianist, you couldn't be playing basketball. Break a finger, then you're screwed.
Well, I played volleyball for a couple of years, and I was always spraining my thumb, and it was a problem.
Yeah, you had to give up that sport. Okay, so since we are at an hour, the last question we always ask, which Melissa Mallow came up with on one of our first podcasts, is do you have any twin stories? Worked with twins, played twins, just no twins in personal life, not in work?
So in the teen theater company that I worked in, there was a pair of identical twins, Michelle and Lily Drexler. And they're both still performing. And do I have a story about them?
But they are still performing.
Yes, I do have a story. At first, it was impossible for me to tell them apart. Mm-hmm. For probably a year and a half, I still couldn't tell them apart. So I had to kind of check in on a different level. What are their individual energies? Because they, you know, like if you actually talk to them, they have very different energies, different personalities, different demeanors. But besides that, they looked very, very similar. Same body type. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they hadn't diverged yet in their physicality. And so just kind of week after week, I kind of got very perceptive about their energy and their demeanor, to the point where I could walk into a room and know which one was which right away.
So you didn't even have to like start talking to them to figure it out. You would just...
I could just tell by their aura.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, most people go off of physical, a birthmark, a freckle, glasses or something like that. I haven't heard of anyone going off of an aura.
It was like, you know, one is a little softer and cuddlier, and the other is a little sharper and more direct. And you could just tell. You walk in the room, you're like, oh, there's the soft and fuzzy one, and then there's the one who's a little more hardcore.
Oh my God, I want to talk to somebody and be like, which one of us is the soft
and which one is the hard, sharp one?
Yeah, I wonder if it depends on when they met us or in what capacity they know us as.
That's true. Because when I'm not working and you're on a show, you're probably the hard one. And I just come and stand next to you during shows.
Right. Right. Oh, that'd be... Oh, ooh, we're going to have to talk to some of our high school friends and ask them this question.
Yeah.
And then go to our college friends and ask them. But then they always knew one of us before the other one.
Well... And then you have other witnesses, even closer.
Yeah, husbands. What, okay, you ask Matt and I'll ask Kai.
I think we have kind of a bias on each side.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be like, well, I think Stacy's more cuddly than you are. I'll be like, excuse me?
Guess we're not sleeping together tonight.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, the one who isn't as cuddly is still cuddly. She's just a little more intense. Not which has its own positives.
Yeah.
And she's a little more assertive, for example.
I think you might be more assertive, twin.
Well, again, I think it's because I'm a stage manager, so it's just kind of built in. I trained myself to be that way.
I'd say that Stacy is pretty cuddly.
Oh, look, I'm the cuddly one. Okay, we'll have to ask other people.
I think I'm going to have to agree with this. I think you are the cuddly one.
Yeah, I don't really push much unless they really piss me off.
Well, you're no pushover, though. I've never seen anyone able to force you into doing anything.
Yeah, well, those happen behind the scenes when nobody's watching. In general, I don't.
Yeah, we didn't get into politics, theater politics at all.
That could be hours of talking.
Yeah, and probably best not done on the record.
Yes, those are done when the microphones are off. Okay, I think we're at an hour. Good twin, do you have any other questions?
Nope, I try to ask them as I go.
Yay, good job.
Cool, thanks guys.
Yeah, thanks for being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
I think you're the first musical director we've had.
Oh.
Right, twin?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've not had a musical director.
Okay.
Nice, excellent. I mean, we've only had 23 podcasts, but still out of 23, you're the first musical director.
Awesome, well, I'm honored.
Yay, okay, thank you, and thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. For more, visit our website at twinstalktheater.podbean.com and subscribe on iTunes or Google Play Music. You can also interact with us on Facebook or Instagram at Twinstalk Theater. Title music, Dance Macabre, is provided by Kevin McLeod of incomtech.com under Creative Commons License 3.0.